This is the Westminster Standard Podcast. I'm Ryan Beasy. Welcome. And today I am joined by teaching elder Doug Servin. Doug, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Great. I'm glad to be on here. Thank you, Ryan.
Oh, well, my pleasure. And you've just gotten back from an anniversary trip to France, as I understand. You feeling well rested?
Yes, I had a great trip. It's our 30th anniversary. We did it all up. And so now I'm like, you know, in recovery mode physically, but also like email-y and getting yourself back in the track. So I think I'm about there. It's been a week back, so I'm good.
Great. Well, thanks for making time. I know that first week back is brutal. And I only travel domestically, so I can't imagine. Well, give me a little bit of your professional background, your ministry background. How did you come to be serving in the PCA?
Sure. Well, I grew up in Southwest Missouri in a small town. I grew up Methodist. I was there every single Sunday. Went to college at the University of Missouri for journalism. And I think my freshman year I came to Christ. I'll be interested to find out what Jesus has to say about that actual timing.
Yeah.
Through the ministry of the Navigators, which I really appreciated. And so then I went on staff with the Navigators at the Oklahoma State University. And it was sort of in those 4 years where I discovered Reformed theology and started reading more and more. I started taking some classes at Covenant by tape, you know, back in the day. And then I eventually went to Covenant in 1997, graduated in 2000, and I went and planted or started the RUF campus ministry at the University of Oklahoma. I did that for 10 years, and then I planted City Presbyterian Church in Oklahoma City. I did that for 10 years, and now I'm in Baltimore, of all places.
Wonderful. So you started an RUF chapter. That's impressive work.
That was fun times, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You have been doing some work on the Elizabeth McIntosh case 34 years ago, a brilliant student at the seminary in her final semester, brutally murdered at the seminary. You've said on another podcast, you devoted a lot of effort and time to thinking about how to raise awareness of this situation. How did you first get interested in this injustice?
Okay, Ryan, when did you find out about the murder?
Let's see. I found out I was at RTS, so it's probably 2010 that I knew that there was a student murdered at Covenant Seminary, and that was about it. I knew that, and it was unsolved.
Yeah,
but it was something that, and other podcasts have talked about this too. That wasn't really something to talk about, not because there was a, you know, censorship, at least at RTS, but it was just that's kind of, you know, that's a Covenant thing, you know, don't go bringing that up. I've talked about it with Covenant grads, and they said they had a different experience, that it was just something that there was some sort of social pressure not to talk about, not that the administration was doing anything. So I found out about it in 2010, I would guess.
Sure, which is normal and fine. We all find out about it different times. I went from 97 to 2000. I think I found out about it like in 2001 or two.
Okay, so after you graduated.
Yeah, so it's this thing, and this is a part of the waters.
Yeah.
Is it's not easy to talk about. No. I don't really begrudge Covenant for not splashing it all over.
Right.
They're like prospective students' packets. But it is a bit weird or disconcerting when you've been there for so long and then you find out about it afterwards. And that's pretty common. I even have a buddy. We were together in Pittsburgh because we were there for Albert Pujols and Yadier Molina's last games on the roster for St. Louis. And I'd already been involved in this podcast, right? And he's Covenant grad from early 2000s, grew up in St. Louis. And I was talking about the podcast, and he had never heard about it. This is 2022.
Hmm.
So, you know, I don't really know exactly the way you should talk about it.
Right.
But so for me, I have tried to be somewhat, however, fallible, a voice for people that maybe don't always have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like white PCA pastors really have a voice. Being a pastor is a very hard job. It's not easy in any sense. But there are so many people in our congregations and midst that don't have voices or don't have the same platform. And so I have just tried, again, imperfectly, to try to let people speak on their own behalf. The trick about that is you don't always get to curate what they say.
Yeah. And you, right. Do you still have your podcast, or has that gone a little bit dormant?
Okay, wait. Let's get back to the podcast. But so Elizabeth is a little bit of a sense of an extreme example of someone who certainly doesn't have a voice.
Right, right.
Who should be known and remembered, I think, in a way more respectful way.
Mm.
And so it has just gnawed on me over the years.
Yeah.
And then it really sort of grew during COVID, where it's like, this is seems sort of ridiculous. We've got to do more than chit chat about it over beers or on Facebook. And so that was sort of the gnawing, like, this woman should be known in the world. And in the PCA and in Covenant Seminary. And so let's talk about her like we sort of say we should. So that's, I think you asked, how did I get interested in this case? We can come back to the podcast, but.
Yeah, because you know, you trying to give a voice to people in your podcast. I know you would interview a number of folks throughout the PCA to let them talk. But yeah, we can talk about that later. So you were at the seminary about 7 years after she was murdered. And there, you said there, you didn't find out about it until a year or two after she graduated. But you were, until recently, a member of the seminary board. How was that experience?
Oh, wonderful. Loved it. Grateful to be on the board. Love Covenant Seminary.
Yeah, yeah. I think, though, on one of the True Believer episodes, you said, or maybe it was one of the ladies on there, that you were not the first choice of Covenant Seminary, but sounds like you had a good time on the board and a productive tenure as a board member.
Yeah. Well, all that means is, you know, there's nominating committee.
Yeah.
And somebody nominated me. And, you know, every institution sort of likes to, like, know what they're getting.
Yes. Yes.
Which is reasonable. And I sort of popped out of nowhere and I didn't ask to do it. And I got voted in and they're like, what the heck? Not in a bad way. Not in a bad way. But so you know, I don't know if you know this, Ryan, a teeny bit of a wild card. You might be too.
Yeah, we probably both are.
So yeah, you know, like, seminary boards don't always like wild cards per se, but I feel like it was a good run. I helped. I loved being a part of it. It was during a transition from Mark Dalby to Tom. And, you know, there's a lot of changes going on in seminaries and in the PCA, and it's hard to navigate.
Mm-hmm.
And I was super grateful to Lynn, whatever I could to help.
Yeah. Yeah. So was it while you were on the board that you started investigating more proactively to try to piece together what you could?
Yeah, I think I got on the board maybe in 2019. I don't know, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And then I really started working on this more in 2020. So there were overlapping years of working on it and being on the board.
Yeah. And one of the things that was mentioned about your time on the board on the True Believer podcast was that you couldn't serve on the board and investigate at the same time. And I was just, that kind of piqued my interest because I thought, well, wouldn't this be something the board would want to have done and have a board member involved in any investigation? So did you get pushback officially from doing that investigation, or was that a personal feeling that it was just improper to be part of the board and doing this?
Well, you'd have to ask them, but I think we eventually mutually agreed that it was a tension point, at least.
Oh, really?
I think it could have been very beneficial, but it didn't end up seeming that way. And so it seemed better for me to like step off and let them do their thing and I could do my thing. So there wasn't any conflict of interest in any sense.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't speak for Covenant Seminary.
No.
I don't speak for Covenant Seminary. They have their own ideas and policies and I have my own. And so, you know, I just don't want to be in conflict with Covenant.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And it seems like Covenant has taken a different path to this than you might, and that many of their alumni wish that they would have. And I don't know that we can fault the seminary for that, because this is kind of a no-win. No matter what you do, people are going to criticize you.
I mean, right.
I graduated from RTS Jackson, and you know, the most infamous graduate that we have is Paul Hill, who murdered an abortionist. And you know, the way the seminary handled that was they kept his graduation photo up, and you know, in the Torah class, Genesis to Deuteronomy class, the instructor used him as an example of, do not apply this theology. This is what, you know, our alumnus did, and that was wrong. And you know, I could imagine people giving grief to the seminary for acknowledging him in any way, but you know, for RTS, that was how they chose to deal with a difficult situation, by owning the graduate and teaching against his theology. Now, in this case, you know, obviously it's an unsolved murder.
Right.
But do you get the sense that there's a reluctance to talk about this is somewhat generational? Now, you know, I think your daughter's about my age, so we're in a different generation, but it seems like the younger generation is more apt to talk about this, whereas some of the older and maybe wiser are reluctant to talk about
this
issue.
How old are you?
I am, oh man, 36, I think.
Yeah. So Ruth is 29.
Okay.
I'm 53. We're really talking somewhat about boomers. And we could talk about boomers for a long time.
And we love boomers.
We love boomers. And boomers will never give up, ever. So they're just going to skip over Gen X, and hopefully they'll land on y'all.
Oh.
So the way it works is there's a generational and institutional memory.
Yes.
And it sort of makes sense when you realize, like litigationally and PR and stuff like that, that we sort of continue to carry on a way to go. And the way to go is, this is an ongoing investigation, so we don't have anything to do with it. We try to participate willingly, happily, but other than that, we don't really communicate about it unless asked by the police or maybe a news source.
Right.
Which I think is very understandable. But I think inside, to me, the problem and the tragic problem is that mindset carried over to her as a person on in a way that didn't matter with the police or the reporters. So like that thought process of like, okay, hands off. It's not that we won't talk about it, but we're not trying to. So this eventually is the thing that grieved me the most, just sort of got me off my duff at least, is, and we talk about this in the podcast, is like no plaque, no memorial, no scholarship, nothing.
Not even a bench.
Yeah, you know, if you would have done a bench the year after, but now we're like, we're way past a bench, yo.
Yeah.
Like, I'm thinking this has got to be something, because when we honor someone, we do something.
Right.
And there's a sense where, like, I guess it doesn't matter how much we spend, but in some sense, like, yeah, we didn't just, like, buy a book or get flowers. So I think we're sort of the point of, like, we have not done anything, and I understand why. It's a weird schizophrenia. Like, I understand why that happened, and I can't believe we're still here.
Yeah, this was 34 years ago.
But, like, you know, when you're on the five-year anniversary, 1995, 2000, 2005.
Yeah.
You know, 2010, 2015, 2020. So, like, all along the way, it's like no one ever thought, I mean, it's just sort of crazy. But it's sort of part of the institutional way we're doing this. No one ever thought we should do something for her on these anniversaries. Seems to me not the covenant way to handle things.
Yeah, but, and I like the way you put that, that this is out of a love for the seminary. This isn't a hostility toward covenant or trying to discredit the seminary. This is an out of a love for the seminary that you have as your alma mater, to want the seminary to do what you believe, and I think a number of alumni believe, is the right thing to do for her legacy.
Well, and I think it's separate from the police. I think it's separate from the media. It's internally. And that way, I think, you know, you don't have to maybe every 5 years you have a service and you talk about her for 5 minutes, or you ring the bells, or some, you know, yearly you ring the bell. There's something where you can say, like, yeah, you know, we didn't talk about this all the time, but we didn't talk about it never. And you could encounter this tragedy, and we understand a way, maybe not the best way, but a way to acknowledge it, name it, lament it, and have it be a part of this place where we say, there's great joy and great sorrow, but Jesus is in charge of all of that.
Yeah.
And so I sort of think that's the understandable mistake. You know, again, you know, like, I see how it happened. And I'm not a prophet or, you know, I don't like being, I know this sounds crazy, but I don't like being controversial, but it just seems like this is something that should happen.
Yeah. Well, what would you like to see the PCA do, you know, within her spheres and her power? I mean, she can't, the church can't bring a murderer to justice, so to speak, but
right.
What would you like to see happen at Covenant, or as, you know, the PCA is the parent institution?
Well, good question. I do, Ryan, tend to think this is a little bit of an exemplar about how we, the PCA, treat women. I don't want to overstate that. I think it's a bit of it. Especially outspoken ones who don't necessarily fit the mold. She did fit the mold in a lot of ways. So I think what the PCA should do, so we're already moving that direction. We're talking about her.
Yeah.
That hadn't happened before. I hope that everybody in the PCA knows who she is and knows that, you know, this isn't a true crime podcast. This is about telling her story and the other right. people who've been affected by this story. And I do believe this is a traumatic story that has ripples and waves over mm-hmm. a lot of things, even unconsciously. But not intentionally. So that's a part of the problem. So like getting her back out in the PCA at all is great. And then like then institutionally doing something at Covenant Seminary, I certainly think a memorial and a scholarship and Day of Remembrance would be completely appropriate and should happen ASAP. Yeah, I think we should all pray for justice. My opinion is that people know things that have never been asked, and those remembrances have never really been mined, which no one has the complete time and space to do that. I don't really begrudge that.
Right.
But right now, TJ and Ruth know more about this than any people in the planet.
Any two individuals, yeah, certainly.
No one knows more about this than TJ and Ruth.
I'm certain of that.
And so we are trying to at least create a record of what actually happened instead of all the myths and rumors and, stories over beers and misinformation. That if anyone knows something, and the thing is, you might know something, and you might think it's unimportant. The police didn't ask you. Well, they didn't ask everyone, right? They don't have unlimited time and power.
Mm-hmm.
Seminary didn't ask. They didn't know to ask you about this thing. So if people have memories or thoughts, they should come in to the two people who know the most about this. So at least there can be a, as best it can be, the most comprehensive record we've ever had. That's the only chance ever this will ever be solved.
And I was trying to solve it, but it's
the best chance it would ever be solved. And at least people can like talk about what they know to people who will listen and care and not be dismissed.
And also to clear the names possibly even of some folks who have been suspects.
Sure.
And that was one thing that I don't remember if it was on when I was talking with your daughter, if it was just something she mentioned on the podcast, there have been significant storylines that have been shared widely that based on the research and the compilation of witnesses that they've done, that is inaccurate, that was speculation, that was exaggeration, that person could not have done it. And, you know, I don't know enough to even know what she was talking about because, you know, I heard one person tell me about this in 2010, and then probably didn't think about it until late 2023 when the preview for the podcast came out.
Right.
Are you considering anything through the church courts, an overture, or, you know, some have said, well, the seminary board should lead on this, and others have said, well, the seminary board works for the General Assembly, so the General Assembly should lead on this. Have you considered an overture?
There's an overture from Chesapeake Presbytery that basically just honors her and asks for prayer. I don't know what any other overture could really accomplish.
Sure.
I mean,
so there's one coming, though.
There is one coming.
Good.
To spend 1 minute in prayer for her in General Assembly. I would hope that would pass because it's not a memorial. So we sort of ban memorials.
Right,
but a memorial is when you like laud somebody's
yes. accomplishments,
achievements, and you talk about it for whatever, 2-3 minutes. This is just saying, whereas Elizabeth was murdered, whereas we have a God of truth and love and mercy, and whereas we have a God of justice, let's pray for 1 minute.
For justice.
Now, I'd like to pray for an hour.
But in the church court, that may not be the most expedient use of time. But
of course,
So your presbytery has set that up already.
Well, at least we get her in the public record.
Yeah.
Of the courts, which is a very Presbyterian solution to something.
Once it's in the record, it's solved, right? In the Presbyterian mindset.
Well, I've conflicted feelings about that, but her father was the stated clerk of a Presbyterian denomination in Scotland, and so that was a bigger deal over there than it is here. So I do think it would honor him to have her in the record, and that we take a minute to pray for her justice, albeit far late. At least it's not never. So I would hope that would seems pretty simple and uncontroversial, except that probably most people still don't even know about this.
Yeah.
Is my guess. Yeah. So is that a solution? I don't know.
Well, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, that's what the church can do, though. We can name things after people. We can pray. We can spread upon the minutes as the language goes. But that's what we can do. And I think a lot of the grief that I've heard from folks attached to Covenant Seminary or graduates is we haven't done anything.
Yeah.
And it's the silence that is speaking volumes in this situation.
Do you have thoughts about what we could do?
I like that idea. I mean, a friend and I drafted an overture. We got it together after my presbytery met, and I didn't think that it was appropriate to call a meeting for this, since there were other presbyteries that were meeting between then and the deadline. And we suggested, name the student union or the student center or a portion of it, after her. Others have said a scholarship or a tree and a, I don't know that it so much matters. I don't want this to sound crass, but I don't know that it matters what we do so long as we do something. I mean, whether it's, room 112B or what, I don't know that so much matters. That's what I mean. But just that something is done and said.
Well, and I think Covenant needs to do it. I don't think Covenant needs to be directed by a General Assembly to do it. They just need to do it. And I think they will do it. It's a busy, obviously crazy time, and they have other things going on. So, but I don't know that we need an overture to direct them to do that. They know that.
Yeah. Yeah, and
that's why now.
Sure, and our intent, and we just put the overture out on a Substack and said, anybody can use this, can adapt it. However, but here's just essentially a placeholder for someone whose presbytery meets within the deadline. I think ours had met 2 weeks before, and we got it up, and there just wasn't time. But this one of the things I saw, kind of switching gears, that I think it was your daughter posted on social media that some people within the PCA are trying to use the project that you and your daughter and TJ are working on to make political points in the PCA, which I think is horrible. Have you noticed that people are trying to turn this into a political club?
Well, Ryan, of course.
Man.
This is shocking. Not everybody likes me. I know that's hard to realize. Also, not everybody likes Brian Chappell and Paul Koistra and Covenant Seminary and Mark Dalby and now Tom Gibbs. So it is very possible to say, Covenant, you're doing a wrong thing. We've been having a hard time figuring out how to get you on stuff. Now we can try to get you on this. And of course, I think that's abysmal and terrible awful beyond belief.
Right. Yeah.
Now, well, I mean, I have my own opinions about it, but it's not political to me. But I just don't think honoring Elizabeth should be any part of any of that.
I agree, and that's what you know struck me by what was posted online, that I haven't seen anyone doing that. You know, I've seen people wanting to honor Elizabeth, but you know there was, you know, some of the people that were interviewed in one of the recent episodes of the True Believer podcast. You know, I was the things that they were saying about Clerk Chapel and former coordinator Koistra, former president Koistra, and I was feeling bad for them, that it was just so brutal in the things that were said about them. And you know, I don't always agree with either of them, but
well, damn, it's hard to be a leader. It's hard to be a leader. Yeah. It's not easy to make decisions. Not everyone's going to like your decision.
Yeah.
You want to be president? Go for it. And everyone's going to hate you, right?
Here's the target to sew on your back so they know where to stick the knives when you become
president. The easiest thing to be is not president, to talk about how terrible the president is doing. When you actually got to be president, guess what? It's not easy. Yeah. You know, we all pastored churches over the COVID. That wasn't easy, right? So just making decisions, I'm super sympathetic to anyone who's trying to make decisions. So I don't want to, you know, Monday quarterback stuff, but it's all in our inclination to always do that. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we have our PCA fights and internal battles, which I always think is mostly silly, but I don't want to use Elizabeth in any sense to have anything to do with any of that.
Absolutely not. Yeah. I just haven't seen, now, you know, I'm not omniscient, but I just haven't seen people trying to do that, you know, to score points, which would be, you know, and I hope people don't take this episode in that way, but that would be entirely inappropriate. No one has anything to gain from trying to, at least I would hope there's nothing to be gained by trying to score points on this. You know, as you said, it was not, there was no way for them to win in whatever course of action they took. And you know, to hear, it sounds like Paul Koistra, you know, was trying to pastor the main suspect through his time at the end of the seminary, you know, even going over to his house for meals. I mean, that
was very difficult, very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, switching gears, Elizabeth is not the only person to whom you've tried to give, you know, a voice or raise awareness for. You produce media for the PCA crowd. How did that interest you? You have a degree in journalism, as I understand it.
Yep. So, Ryan, when did you start going with the bow tie?
Probably 2009.
Yeah.
I think that's when I learned how to tie a bow tie. No, 2008, because it was the retirement party for my pastor in college. It was 2008.
And so is this a frequent look for you?
Yes. Not as frequent as it used to be. You know, in Mississippi, it's about 50% bow tie. But now that I'm in Georgia, it's a little bit less bow tie.
Nice. And you tie them yourself. I would do clip-on.
I do. What's that?
I would do clip-on, but that's uncool.
I can't do clip-on. Yeah.
Somebody, well, it looks good. Okay, so I've always been a journalism major. I have ADHD. I'm all over the place. So in 2020, I had nothing to do. I don't even know what I did. I always say in 2020, I made plans and canceled them.
Hmm.
I wrote emails and didn't send them. I would write 15 emails and not send any of them. So I was going crazy. Now, this was also, I don't know if you remember, the PCA is going downhill faster than ever. The PCA is completely going liberal. The PCA, the sky is falling in the PCA. We are in trouble. I never thought that was true. I don't think that's true. I still don't think that was true. I think that was a false narrative. Very problematic, actually. So this was an attempt to, you know, lightheartedly talk about things in the PCA that aren't terrible, at least in my opinion.
Yeah.
So we started having people on. Now, you know, I obviously curated these people. I will say, if we do an episode, season three, I'm going to try to have other voices that maybe disagree with my take on the PCA. But the first two seasons were pretty much who I wanted to talk to or who Justin wanted to talk to. I didn't know everybody that we talked to. But it's, you know, an hour of pretty lighthearted banter about how the PCA is okay, what we're doing, what's going on. And then, you know, I think it's semi-serious because we're trying to tell people stories about what they're doing. But then mm-hmm. there's this, certainly, I mean, I feel like you're trying to do something serious, which is great. My was like, whoa. We always take ourselves too seriously. So, like, that's when, of course, I had unlimited time. I wasn't spending money on anything. So I made these crazy, idiotic theme songs and music.
I remember some of those. Those were funny. I thought they were funny. Some people thought they were just the end of the world, but I thought, at least, you know, one or two that you sent me, I thought it was funny. I was like, you know,
we're on
the different ends of the spectrum on a lot of things.
But well, I'm glad you thought they were funny because they were funny.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, whatever, yo, let's not take ourselves so seriously. It's sort of my weird sort of sabotage against the seriousness of everybody doing everything in bow ties and whatever.
Bow ties and seersucker, right?
Just kidding. Yeah. Seersuckers. So it ends up to be a fairly lighthearted interview process. We probably did, 40, 50 of them. And we pretty much had a good time. It's not journalism. It's just talking, but it gave me like stuff to do, honestly,
and people, media to consume.
Well, and yeah, so like a little bit of anti the sky is falling, a little rebellion against that narrative without mm-hmm. calling it out per se,
right?
Is what I sort of was in my mind. Now, like, there were certainly times I was mad about other things, and sometimes that might have crept in, and I'm sorry about that. But yeah, it wasn't any great journalistic endeavor like this podcast is, for sure. The True Believer Podcast.
Yeah. They are doing. I can't imagine, because you know I know how much effort it takes to produce a podcast with two guys or three guys or four guys just talking, but yeah. What they're doing. Ruth, I think, posted the other day on social media that, by the way, this isn't my full-time job, but
oh gosh,
it really must be consuming at least 20 hours a week.
Thousands of hours. Sure.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, like iHeartPCA consumed fives of hours. Not 0 hours, but I needed something to do, and it was sort of fun. And yeah, I hope people got a informative chuckle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a place for that. I mean,
I don't think we should fight near as much. So,
yeah, I think David Cassidy called them food fights in the PCA.
That seems silly to me.
Yeah. So how do you? You know, how did you, and you also publish books, I think, you know, you publish for other people. How do you, it seems like you just, one of the things, a passion that you seem to have is giving people, of producing media, a voice, as you call it.
Right. Yeah. So the first book we did was Helis Emmanuel, and that was connected to the racial reconciliation overture, right? And so if you remember, it came up as a personal motion, and then it got tabled for a year. And then we talked about it again, and maybe the second time was in Chattanooga. I don't exactly remember where we were.
I think Ligon Duncan made the motion in Chattanooga, and then it came back in Mobile.
Okay, right. Yeah, I had a lot of oysters in Mobile. So in the intervening year, I thought, well, let's... People have written about these things. You know, this isn't the first time. So I just started gathering other people's already written stuff. And I had a publisher, and then he sold his company like in January, and I realized we had to do it ourselves. So we published that book, and that sort of got me started in trying to help, especially PCA pastors, PCA women, PCA women of color, to get out there because they wouldn't normally get published by a traditional or even niche publisher. Mm-hmm. So it is connected to, I want your voices to be heard. Now, I think our PCA voices should be heard. I think they're amazing voices. But again, I don't agree with everything everybody says. So like right. When you give over to people say, you know, I get criticism back. It's like, I didn't say it. Well, you shouldn't have published it. I don't think that's fair. I think people get to say what they want and deal with the consequences, and I'll deal with their consequences. And of course I give feedback and pushback and whatever. So it's been 10 years maybe. We've done quite a lot of books, and I'm mostly proud of the ones for the people that would have never got published anywhere else.
Hmm. You know, you raise a point that people, you know, they criticize this program, that, you know, they criticize the podcast that you're helping with, True Believer, you know, for allowing certain perspectives and certain opinions. You know, how do you, you know, as a publisher, you know, where do you draw the line where someone says, you know, and you're reading it or you're hearing it and, ooh, that people are not going to like that perspective. Where do you draw the line to say, I'm going to cut that? Or I'm not going to publish this work at all. Or is there anything between where you just let them say what they're going to say?
No. Oh, I wouldn't just publish anything anybody says.
Yeah.
It has to be in the ballpark. But there are things that people say that ruffle feathers that probably should get ruffled.
Mm.
But, you know, heresy and accusations but you know, like, if you're a single black woman in the PCA, you might have a different perspective than you and me, so you should get to talk about that. If that doesn't mean you're being, I don't think necessarily disrespectful, it means you're trying to be heard, and maybe you haven't been heard. So, yeah, it's certainly a judgment call, and I tend to defer to the person because I don't want to gaslight people.
Right.
Or, you know, none of us would want to, but I don't agree with everything everyone says, but I can live in a universe where that's okay.
Yeah, right, you know? Right.
It doesn't bother me too much to have some gray areas in all this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it bothers me some to have other, you know, so I'm not whatever.
Right, right.
But yeah. I try to be respectful for the voices. We don't have to have everything buttoned down exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think.
Yeah. Well, as we kind of bring it in for a close, where would you like to see, you know, we just celebrated our 50th anniversary as the PCA. Where would you like to see the PCA in 25 years? What does the PCA look like in 25 years? Or what would you like it to look like? What does faithfulness look like?
Are you going to answer first?
I would like to see.
It's a big question.
Yeah. No one's ever asked me that on this show. I would like to see the PCA become, more faithful, more holy, more peaceful, more committed to the means of grace, word, sacrament, prayer, more zealous for evangelism, and to hold fast to that faith once for all delivered in a world that is so desperately in need of the joy of the gospel. I'd like to see us looking back at our 75th and say, wow, the aspirations of our founding fathers have just blossomed. Our founding fathers, they all had their problems, or at least the vast majority of them did. Maybe there was one who was perfect. I don't know. But they all had their problems, but in those crooked sticks, look at what the Lord has done with the PCA now 75 years later, and how faithful she is to the scriptures and the Reformed faith and the Great Commission.
Well, it's hard to fault that answer. So I wholeheartedly agree. Except I think we're doing that.
Hmm.
So more doing that is hard for me to imagine, because I think we're doing it. So I think we're growing, and we have great ministries and great churches. The big problem I see is infighting.
Mm, yeah.
And backbiting and accusation making. So what I would hope is that we would okay, listen, yo. We are all conservative, reformed Presbyterians. In the PCA, you don't get more conservative reform than that. Conservative reform. So can we just do it and be okay with each other? It feels like right now, no, we can't.
Yeah.
And that to me is the most biggest problem. Is pinpointing the things we disagree with, but we sort of agree that we can do it different ways within the umbrella of who we are. We all agree to the confession. We all agree to the standards. We all agree to the basic order of worship. I mean, I don't think there's any church that doesn't. Now, there's probably blips along the way, and those people eventually get called out and maybe leave, which is the way the process works.
Yeah.
So I just think there's a little bit of chill pill of it's not perfect. It's never going to be perfect, but it's good. And the heat that's come over the last 4 or 5 years to me is very disconcerting.
Hmm.
We have debates about things that nobody else is debating about, which is fine. I think we should be able to debate those things, but I really hope we could respect each other's ministry, even if we wouldn't do it that way.
Hmm.
Because we're different people in the same denomination, in different contexts, with different influences. But we all pretty much... I know people disagree with me on this. We are so close to each other. But once you start saying no, you are so far away... It just is really hard to take.
Hmm.
So that's where I think, I hope in the next 25 years, we're like, okay, yeah, we're good. We're good. We're good. We have different voices. We have different influences. Fine. Some of them might be concerning, or there may be strains of those, or people go off in the wrong direction in any of them. Totally true. But, you know, now I also think, let me say this, Ryan. I do think our court system is not amazing. So I would hope that in the next 25 years, we would do some reformation on the way we deal with cases.
Yeah.
Because I think we've sort of internalized a self-fulfilling prophecy that we're doing it right, and we always do it right, and we take care of each other. But, you know, we're not lawyers, and I just think we continually often mess all this up. Mm. So I would hope that there would be a little bit of a reform, or a reform, on our court systems. And I would say that would include women involvement. I don't know what that means exactly, but when you just have a bunch of dudes figuring stuff out who aren't lawyers, I think we could improve that process.
Yeah, I know Sean Lucas has called for synods in the PCA, and he didn't elaborate on what he meant by that, and I think, you know, that is something to consider. I think, though, others, you know, and there's an overture, yes, it's up now, about having women involved in investigation processes, and there just seems to be a different perspective, you know, that some, you know, and I would be in this camp, that we're a church, the church courts are comprised of elders, and so the elders will do the investigation. Now, that's not to preclude a civil investigation or a criminal investigation that might use other resources, but for a church court, we're going to make use of the church courts, and if we have to call in experts, we can call in experts. But the investigation should be done by the elders. But I certainly see your perspective that unordained people would have insights to give. It's just how we factor those in, how we deploy those resources.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think church courts are inherently fraught with problems.
Yeah, yeah.
It's always been true. It's still true. So yes, you're right. But yes, we have to identify the problems with that approach,
yeah,
which seem numerous and easy to name and possible to mitigate against.
Duncan Rankin, I'm not sure if you know him, but you know, I was involved in something awful in the congregation that I serve. And you know, I'd asked a question on the Facebook group, or one of them, you know, gave scant details, but enough to know, for Duncan Rankin to know that I was in over my head. And one of the things he said to me was, Ryan, the problem with pastors is they think they are lawyers and they think they are the police. You don't need to figure this out. Yeah. What you need to do is collect a record and send it on to the civil magistrate. And I was so thankful that Duncan Rankin reached out, because, you know, we could have, they were just things and images and awful things that, like, I don't want to have to deal with this. And, you know, Duncan Rankin just, Ryan, you don't have to deal with that. Just send it on to the proper authorities. And I think that a lot of pastors, and maybe it's a younger pastor type of a situation, think that they don't get that same counsel. They don't get that counsel quickly enough, that just call the police. Now, thankfully, it wasn't involving a child or anything of that. And when the police were informed, they kind of said, eh. But I was glad that, you know, I had that counsel, that just call the police. Refer it to them. This is not something that you need to, you know, store evidence for the next 500 years.
Well, sure. But even without, I just don't think we know what we're doing. We didn't have this class in seminary. We think we know what we're doing. We're not trained counselors. We're not trained lawyers. We mess up the BCO all the time.
Oh, I've seen that.
And we're the ones who's supposed to know what the BCO, but much less anyone who doesn't know the BCO. Much less if you're a you know, woman coming in to a group of five, six elder men. I mean, I just think it's all completely understandably not good.
But that's
something ignorance. I hope it changes in 25 years.
Yeah, yeah. And I tell you, the more...
Let's do it now.
But I tell you, the more I understand, the more I learn, I'm doing an officer training class now, and the more I study our polity, the more I love it. You know, I see how biblical it is. Now, it's nuanced. There's a huge learning curve, but I see the biblical principles that have been applied. And so, if there's a way to teach that and to instill that, I think we could be a much more beautiful denomination in 25 years. But, well, Doug, I really appreciate your time and thanks for coming on and sharing. Anything you'd like to say in closing?
No, thanks. I'm glad we can talk about Elizabeth. That's my main goal. PCA politics, whatever. But honoring Elizabeth and keeping her as the main focus is what's most important. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for joining the conversation on the Westminster Standard, which is the podcast of Jude 3. For additional resources or to make a donation, visit our website, jude3pca.org. As a reminder, the opinions and views expressed on the Westminster Standard podcast are not necessarily those of Jude 3 and the PCA. On this program, we try to bring you a variety of perspectives, and we do not edit our guests for content, but hope to foster greater dialogue and understanding as we promote the historic, old-school Reformed faith throughout the Presbyterian Church in America. We return to our weekly distribution schedule in May, so please join us again next week as we welcome back Teaching Elder George Sayor, as well as Dr. Jesse Ryan of the Center for Academic Faithfulness and Flourishing, and we'll be discussing the nature of higher education and the search for a Christian college. I'll talk to you then.